I added, "Why am I in pain?" Now, after yesterday, I thought it was still a very apt title, because all of you had really felt strongly about the woman's movement. I mean, really, and I do too. We all feel strongly about the woman's movement. And the two men that came, one felt very strongly about the woman's movement, and the other one did too. Now, because there are so many new people here, I ask this question. On a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being, you know, the top, the most wonderful thing that's ever happened, and 1 being, let's get out of it, where would you rate the woman's movement? And most of the people there rated the woman's movement below 5, if not 1, and probably if I said 0 to 10, they put it 0. The man, younger man, rated a 9.5. Because why?
Because he's in the youth generation.
Well, you know, that's what he did. Now, I left you with a statement that I'm going to read, because it's all based on this. It's a historical statement. The research and the opinion of Dr. Elise Boulding, former sociologist at Dartmouth College, a Quaker, and her husband is Kenneth Boulding, the economist. Very talented family, musicians in our area. And she wrote one of the best books, History of Women. Really, there have not been histories of women. She did all her research, a great deal of research, in Roman Catholic archives, because those were the women who kept the history of women. And she says that we are in an axial age, AXIAL. And she said there have been 2 before this time. And she talks about women being part of the design of community, that women are futurists. And the reason we have the futuristic skill, now this is not to say that men don't have it, but this is one thing, kind of an instinctive thing, a skill that women had to develop, that they had to plan their meals. What are we going to have today? What are we going to have for the rest of the week? They gave birth to children, and they looked at each one of them and said, I'd like to think that Johnny or Mary or whatever would grow up to be like this. Sometimes in the United States we used to say, I hope he grows up to be president of the United States. Or now he and she grow up. You have the chance to be president, but I don't know how many of us want to be president anymore. But nevertheless, we are futurists. We look towards the education of our child. We have all the hopes and dreams. This is not unique to the United States. It's unique. It's a condition that's all over the world with most mothers who give birth to babies. Most. Now, I had one woman say, well, how about those mothers that don't want their children? Well, let's not consider that right now as part of the argument, but most of us throughout the ages. Now, the first axial age is very interesting because it goes back to the beginning of Christianity. The teachings of Jesus about the human possibility brought thousands of women out of their homes to help shape a new society. By the 4th century, when Christian church was already becoming institutionalized and the urban corruption of the Mediterranean society was clearly continuing unchecked, by the new vision, many women fled these cities to live in the desert and work more seriously at the problem of human transformation. Now, that doesn't mean that every woman left, but that means that some did and impact the history from then on. The next axial age was in the 13th and 14th centuries, when European women in large numbers left home and families to enter convents or create lay urban communities. While many of the women infected with the New Ageism were recluses or nuns, they had a powerful impact on their own time and are reappearing in our own like a delayed time bomb. Thus, after an apparent break of some centuries in the tradition of seeking to understand and develop the human potential with divine guidance. Today, many women's religious orders are rediscovering the hermit tradition. Again, we are in the axial age, standing at a threshold, and business as usual will not take care of the insistent inner demands to return to the unfinished business of reconstruction of human beings. While the work has often called women out of families to a life of celibacy, thousands of women embark on this task in the midst of an apparently ordinary working and home life. Now, I left with that, and we had some differences in what the woman's movement is all about, and I think they were genuine. I asked one question, and I said to Bill, God in wondrous ways leads me to ask that question. I still think it's a good one. If you had a television to sell for $500 million, and you knew that you could take and put all that money into your dream, your plan, which happens to be environment, ecology, would you sell the television for $500 million, or would you keep the television as a woman? Two women in Seattle are selling their television empire. Well, it's almost more. It's Seattle, Portland, Spokane, Boise,
Idaho Falls,
plus radio stations, and the asking price is $500 million. They could keep it. Their mother kept it. So there you go. Now you can figure that out, and at the end of the session, which will be tomorrow night, we might discuss that a little bit. Now, I think you have to say, after what I've read, and I think we understand that in history, some women have been participants in the historical change or in the social dynamics. Maybe they didn't want to be. Maybe they just got caught in it. Maybe they wanted to be. On the other hand, some, like the rest of the society, have been recipients, whether they have liked it or not.
I think they have always been.
You've always been part of the change?
Yeah.
In some way, they have done it. But in other ways, like all human beings, some have objected to it. Now, we'll go on. Let me give you a little history here before we go into the discussion. In 1975, there was a conference in Mexico City declared by the United Nations. When the United Nations was created, there was a very active woman in it. Does anybody know who it was?
Eleanor Roosevelt.
Right, Eleanor Roosevelt. And there was a woman, Helvi Sipola, and I said she was Swedish, but she's Finnish. also was the first woman executive or head of a commission in the United Nations. It was her dream, along with Alva Myrdal and this woman, Elise Boulding, that there should be an international women's conference sometime, let the women get together. So 1975 was declared International Women's Year. You've all known the year of the child, the year of this, the year of that. Well, that was the year of the woman. All of the countries that they could get, mostly in our Western Hemisphere, those not under the domination of the Soviet Union, took a very active part. Betty Friedan had written her book on women in the U.S., which kind of gets everything started. And I heard her at one conference in Copenhagen walk up. I started this whole thing. Well, she didn't exactly start this whole thing. She just wanted a place in line. But anyway, Betty Friedan had written her book. There were kind of movings in the Asian communities, in the African community, and in the European communities. We got together in Mexico City, and four women went from the state of Washington, and there might have been a few that came later, but four I know of for sure. I was one of them. That was how interested people were in it. It was open to every woman in the world. And it was interesting to note that those in other countries were far more interested in that conference than they were. Now, there was a man that went with us from the state of Washington, and he can express himself later, right over there. Bill went with me, and it was a real eye-opener for him. The main thrust of that conference was equality. The United States delegation went with quite a bit of influence because they were still in the glory when the United States had a great deal of influence at that time around the world and a great deal of respect. We were still in that kind of era. But the minute we got there, we could tell that life was going to be different. They had two sections, one an official conference and one the Tribune. Now, I was part of the Tribune. These were organizations, all women's organizations, Lutheran, United Methodist, the YWCA. As a matter of fact, the YWCA was in charge of the Tribune. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Business and Professional Women, the American Association of University, big long list. What happened was that they had this official side of it where the United States and all other countries sent official delegates. Like at that time, it was Betty Ford, wife of the president. Jill Rockleshoff, the Republicans were in. Jill Rockleshoff, and I can't remember the rest of them. Ghana sent Judge Annie Giaki, who is a Presbyterian. She was an official representative, a Supreme Court justice. I became a very good friend of hers in Ghana. That was that. But they were official. They were passing official types of things. But the action was at the Tribune. And the official group soon found out that that's where the action was. And they all wanted to come over because we were discussing the theme, peace, equality, and economic development. Betty Friedan, who was big in this country, suddenly realized there was a young woman from the YWCA in the Pacific Island, wasn't it, Bill, that took over the chair, the guidance of that conference, instead of the United States. People from third world countries came to play an equal role, and they did. It was a little shocking because the U.S. women were pretty confident that they had the whole thing together. And there we learned a lot. We didn't have the whole thing together. The next conference was in Copenhagen. There were to be, well, at that conference they decided that they would, they, out of it came the statement on the elimination of discrimination, sexual discrimination. I've got that, and I'm going to read it to you right here, so you'll know what came out of it. The Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And it states, the full and complete development of a country, the welfare of the world, the cause of peace, requires the maximum participation of women on equal terms with men. This was a statement that came out of the women representing all the countries that came, I think, 49, 50, I don't know how many. That came out. Then a plan of action came out of there. Part of the plan of action was to hold conferences in every country. We did. Between 1975, 1980, in 1977, we held a conference in Houston. Every state held a conference themselves. I was part of the one in the Washington state. We made out a plan of action. We did all our homework. A lot of this came out of Washington, D.C., but the part of it came out of the women's groups, United Methodist Women, Lutheran Women. We had everybody. We took our plan of action to Houston. At Houston, they got together and they discussed, and they came out with a U.S. plan of action. I looked in your library here, and you don't have one, and I have maybe two or three. I really ought to give one. If they're about that big. And the plans of action generally included, for us anyway, our concern of daycare centers, our concern of violence on women, you name it. Homemakers had something there. The farm women had statements there. Women in politics, women in business. They all had plans of action that have influenced our country. One of the biggest influences you will probably see anywhere are the revelation and the coming out of the battered women home. That was a real concern there. Women who were abused and battered, children who were abused and battered, daycare centers, that all came out of that. On the other hand, there was a woman who did not want to take part, Phyllis Schlafly. And she set up another conference in Houston, too. Now, she represented what we will call, for convenience, anti-feminist. While the others, we can't call feminists because they weren't all feminists. They were just women who were in the women's movement. But Phyllis, tomorrow I'm going to discuss a little bit of that conflict because I think it's important for people to understand what happened. Well, anyway, she had her, and she was going to impact that conference because the Planned Parenthood and pro-choice groups were at the main conference. And also she was definitely opposed to the ERA, and the main conference approved of the Equal Rights Amendment. And of course, as you know, it didn't pass. Phyllis Schlafly had a very fine political organization, fine in the terms of well-organized, and scared the politicians to death, and it did not pass. However, that particular year, those years, then ended up in Copenhagen. at the mid-decade conference. Now, I said the YWCA, Young Women's Christian Association, was in charge of the Mexico City. In charge of Copenhagen was the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Peace groups took over. Peace groups from all over the world. And they more or less, it was the peace time. At that particular conference, you had that paper, the Bill's paper?
It's on that seat right over there.
Yeah, right there. Would you mind holding that up? On the other side is the Reverend Chibuku, right there opposite Bill. That woman was there, and she spoke to both what they called then the forum, that was open to all of us, and then the official conference. That's the woman, she happens to be from South Africa. The same style of operation, but out of that one, this elimination of discrimination was signed by all the countries there. We signed it, the leadership there, and the name escapes me. I want to say Virginia. But that wasn't official, because we had to bring that back to the United States and have Congress approve of it. Congress has never approved of it. Most of the rest of the countries have signed it, put it into operation as much as they could do, and have representatives and meet every so often. But we can't meet with them because we've never signed that convention. Just like we haven't signed a lot of other UN commitments. We don't sign that one. But that came out of that. And more plans of action. We began to get a little more sophisticated as we went along. We found that African women wanted to have, in South Africa, they wanted to get rid of apartheid. We found that African women in Northern Africa wanted to get rid of the hunger problem, naturally, and they were concerned about their children. We heard from the woman who was married to a miner down in Peru. And we heard about Central America over and over again. We were beginning to hear a lot of things like that. Also, I failed to mention that I attended a conference in East Berlin in 1975, which was the Soviet Union's answer to the one in Mexico City. Now, the Soviet Union sent delegates all the time. They were always there. But they weren't happy because they weren't in on the planning of the UN conference. And one reason they weren't in on the planning of the UN conference was that Betty Friedan didn't think they ought to be. Now, that you can read that in her It Changed My Life. But nevertheless, they went on and that was a lesson for me. I was one of 100 women who went from the United States. If you want a learning situation, entirely different mentality, that was the place to be at that time. Now, all those countries that took part in that, plus all the nations of the world, also came, all the rest of the countries, the same ones that went to the UN one, were there. Different people, but they were there. And it was, as I say, a little bit, they did everything by consensus. Everything by consensus. And the men ran the conference. And consensus could be one man. Yeah, we agree with that one. That's mine. That was part of it. There was no discussion. It was really, as I say, very interesting experience. But some people liked it. I didn't. Then in 1985, we had the conference in Nairobi. I didn't get to attend that one, but we sent, as National Church Women United, an airplane load of women. Now, that was an interesting conference for the fact that you might say, well, where was this, the church in all of this? Well, I'll tell you where the church was at that conference. One of the presidents of the World Council of Churches ran it. Dame Nita Burles, and she was a health professional. It was very well organized when you consider all the hundreds, thousands of women that came from all over the world. If any of you been to Kenya and descended upon that country, that was a masterful situation, or misterful situation to handle all those women. And out of that conference, they had hoped to be continued the women's issues in some way, and they're still thinking, yeah, we'll have another one. But here's where it's an interesting thing. The church in 1983 picked up on the conferences for women and held their own conference. The World Council of Churches is in 1983,
too? Yeah, one or three, I'm not sure.
Well, guess who was in charge of that? Dr. Constance Parvey, Lutheran theologian. And she was the director of that whole conference, which was held in Sheffield, England. And it was the first time the World Council of Churches created a process where the grassroots people could be part of the conference and the decision making and development. They were very interesting in the fact that they sent out to urban areas, to rural areas, to countries all over the world, a study program where they could cooperate. They had women and men from countries all over the world that went through a 6 weeks, was it, study program?
It was most of the year?
Well, anyway, Seattle took part of it because we were an urban group. And we studied these issues. We studied theology. We studied biblical interpretation. And we looked at all these issues in the eyes of women and men. The World Council of Churches, those women had been working on the World Council of Churches since about 1972. They'd held conferences, and they decided they would not leave men out, that it was very important for men to be included in the discussion. And we tried to have a balanced group, that is, so many women, so many men. People from the gay community, and we had people from the black community, and the people from the Asian community, and we discussed these issues. They said everyone must participate, and men and women had to look at issues which exploited each other. Not just men exploiting women, but women and men exploiting each other. Well, we went to Sheffield, and I went on as a reporter for that paper. One of the issues, and I'll just say this, that the U.S. wanted to consider, and most all of them did, but they decided to put on the back burner, was the ordination of women. And they did bring it up. In fact, Bill made a proposal, a recommendation, that they vote on whether women should be ordained or not. Everybody, including the Soviet Union, voted for the ordination of women. Now, these were countries from...
It was a straw vote.
It was a straw vote, yeah. From all over the world. Japan, South Africa, Greece, Mideast, so on and so forth, and the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, how would they, well, as you say, a straw vote, so there was nothing they could adopt.
They had.
The Lutheran church has had it for over 20 years.
Oh, well, yeah, so did the Methodists, and that was one of the reasons so we picked it up, because it would be ridiculous for us to go to a conference where they wouldn't even talk about it. So they did talk about it, but it never got into the report. Never got into the report. And we do not have to cooperate with the World Council of Churches. We do not have to give the World Council of Churches authority. And that was when Bill and I were going to do this together, the discussion in his group on this morning on community is very, we give authority, this is, we grant authority to people to do the work, but we're the ones that do that. But there, they would not consider. And to this day, they won't talk about it. Emil Castro, who is the director, is executive director, like Bill was executive director of Seattle. He's executive director of the World Council of Churches. He came to Seattle. I asked him the question, and he said, there are many women who do not feel that ordination of women is important. Of course, I think that's...
I imagine that's all over the United States, too.
What? That do not think that...
That's right.
Our seminaries today are over 50% women.
I know.
They must want something.
That's because those individual women want it.
But anyway, that's the background of the woman's movement. Now, in our global communities, we found, this is the discussion, because this wasn't what we were discussing yesterday. And in our local communities, the social fabric of society is fragmented by racism, classism, sexism, denominationalism, nationalism, and materialism. This came out of the Sheffield Report. Women have historically been creators and sustainers of community. I consider community a crucial value for a healthy society. Women, however, have reflected the values and the systems that divide them. Now, would you like to discuss that a little bit? Women reflect the values and systems that divide them. And the values and systems that divide them are racism, classism, sexism, denominationalism, nationalism, and militarism. Do you think that we do reflect those values? One head nods. Anybody in this room reflect those values?
I don't even know that I'm following you.
Okay, good. Let's get down what he says. What in our communities...
I heard what you said.
Okay.
Okay. Tell me what reflect means in that sentence.
All right, that when we go into a black community, how do you think they look at us? Do they say, wow, here comes a white woman?
No.
No.
All right, that's reflecting something. How about the Native Americans, when the whites go in and say, well, we're going to build a condominium over here on
Are we reflecting it then? Are we the women that are going in there and doing this to them?
What color are we? What type of society do we support that would do a thing like that?
Yes, but we don't have that much power.
We don't have that much power as women?
Nope, I don't really think we do. We think we do, but I don't think we do.
Do the men have that much power?
I think they do.
Boom.
I think we want things. I mean, I think we as women as mothers and grandmothers, desire things for not only our family and our children, but our country. I wrote Barbara Bush about that very same thing, because I didn't think maybe it'd do any good to write President Bush because he would not get the letter. And she wrote back and agreed, but guess who it was that gave me the final answer? A man. And it was diametrically opposed to what I wrote Barbara Bush. What? So we have reflections of our inner souls, but that doesn't, it's like looking in a mirror. And if the mirror is cracked, you don't see the true picture.
What did, would you mind saying what you, do you want to say what you wrote about?
Well, maybe I've mentioned this to quite a few people and they vigorously deny what I say because they say there must be freedom of everything in America. But I was upset about the laxness of the people who are given the money by the National Endowment for the Arts and how the money is spent. When they depict in some of our galleries, mainly Cincinnati, a picture of Christ in a bottle of urine, a picture of Christ where he has a tourniquet around this arm and he's holding the rubber with his teeth and he's injecting heroin in. I object that being in a museum. Now the answer was, you don't have to go to the museum and look at that. But I object my tax dollars being spent for that. The people that I've talked to say that, well, you know, you start not having freedom, pretty soon it'll hit the books and, you know, you destroy freedoms. But again, they're my tax dollars and I feel this is...
And you don't feel that you have any power?
No.
To change that situation
at
all?
No, because they're still hanging in the gallery and they came right out on 2020 or 60 Minutes and they said that there's been a grassroots thing against this, but the gallery owners said, once we start having squelching anything in the arts as well as education, then we're becoming as bad as Russia. We're not permitting freedoms, you know, our freedoms. So what do you do about it?
Do they have Christ's name on the photo?
No, but they had a picture and you knew who he was.
Yes, but Solomon painted his concept of Christ. Does anybody actually have to look at any idea what Christ looked like? It isn't that so much as what he was doing.
Yeah. No, it's
did. No, I know, but when using Christ's picture, Solomon just had his own version of what Christ looked like. Does anyone really know?
Well, you know, the wonderful senator, right now, he slips my mind. He's our wonderful senator in the South, Kentucky or Tennessee. He's been fighting this. He was
Jesse
one of the...
Jesse Helms?
Yes, Jesse Helms.
He's a wonderful senator.
Okay.
You know what he stands for?
But they also did a picture of him in a bottle of urine, and they had his name on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's definitely disappointing, but nobody knows what Christ looked like, do they? That's only Solomon painted his version.
Okay, we have established powerlessness. That is powerlessness. That is a good illustration. But I think we want to get beyond, but that's a good illustration of powerlessness. You just can't go up to the government and say, change it, because they don't change it. And I might take that as a kind of an illustration, the fact that why the women loved the Tribune and the Forum and the free part of it, because that was run by United Methodist women and all sorts of women like that said, no, we get to discuss everything we want to discuss. We can come to our own conclusions. And those are non-governmental agencies represented in the UN as a non-governmental agency. You have it, I have it, Y has it, Women's International, and they're powerful. They're powerful. That's not a weak group. That's one of some of those associations you talk about, isn't it, in your program. The more associations you belong to, the more fun you have. Well, you can belong to any one of those. Anyway, the next thing that I wanted to talk about, that sometimes, and I want to say this again, the decade that we've just been through was declared for all women. The World Council of Churches has just declared another decade. And it's called In Solidarity with Women. It goes from 1988, how many have heard about it, to 1998. It's called In Solidarity with Women. The Church's In Solidarity with Women. And it has several suggestions I think I left that home. I was going to take that up tonight and I left the other home. But anyway, it has several points that they'd like to discuss. The woman's position and equality within our churches. Some of the women's concerns. I mean, this when they say churches in solidarity with women, they're not talking about women in solidarity with women. They're talking about men and denominations in solidarity with women.
But that includes women.
Yes, but the women have an opportunity to raise their issues and to examine their churches and denominations on an equal basis. See, this wouldn't work too well, and this is a hard task in my church, which is the United Methodist Church, because we have a bishop system, and we have a council of bishops, and we're just beginning to equalize men and women. But by the end of the decade, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it would be 50%. The Church Council of Greater Seattle. How many women they had on your board when you came, Bill?
In 1970, I came and there were 4 women out of 35 people on the board. And I wasn't keeping track of it. I hate to say it, I wasn't very aware of it. And but they're now 51%.
Oh. I think that's where they'll go.
Yes, and it will be that way. The other thing, if you attended the service last night, that liturgy was taken out of a worship and liturgy it's more than a magazine, less than a book, that they have sent out for all churches and denominations, and there are many wonderful, all languages, going all over the world. It's a marvelous feeling of networking. It's like any of you have taken part in World Day of Prayer with Church Women United. Have anybody here take part in World Day of Prayer? It's a historic thing that came out of Michigan. Wonderful thing that women have done for years and years and years is to declare one day as a World Day of Prayer for all women. That's the way women work. If you look at history, you can look at history and you can pick up many outstanding men.
But you say for all women. When I go to a World Day of Prayer, it's for everyone.
Well, men can come too. We've never barred men out of anything.
And isn't there a woman behind every man? Togetherness in the home? Or do you have a why you're splitting them?
I am not splitting men and women. We're bringing together as a church, I think that's. Yeah, but what we're doing is that we are, as I said, we're on a threshold of change. Women instinctively sense that. Some women don't. Some women don't care. Some women are busy with their own problem. We've discussed that too. Too many women working should have some time to do rearing the family. The family is the future. So on and so forth. But there are other women who sense a vital change in history. And I would say, when I read you this little thing, Staying Alive, and this is from a woman in India, when within the next 10 years or 15, we'll have no more tropical forests. No more.
Right.
I would say that's scary. When, during this same particular time, our military, world military budgets, that is, working on military for wars, increased from about $200 billion to over $400 billion in a short period of time. As a woman with children and grandchildren, I would be worried.
I am.
Okay?
I'm very worried.
I think men would be worried, and I think there are men worried. I know men who sit in jail. But does the government worry? We just moved into Iraq. No, not one government has said, you know, very, very quietly, well, that might not be the right thing to do. And I know one thing, they didn't call and ask me. And I don't know of any other woman that they called and asked either. Do you think this is the right thing to do? You can call Barbara Bush, she agreed with you.
See, that's
didn't make
said,
any difference.
That's
move
why I, said,
right
I don't
on.
Think we have that much power, because these things are getting worse.
They found that in the end of the decade, if you want to know the answer to that one, at the end of the decade, the uniform conclusion of the decade's research is that with few exceptions, women's relative access to economic resources, incomes, and employment has worsened. Their burden of work has increased, and their relative and even absolute health, nutritional, and educational status has declined. You're right. Except in exceptional cases. I went on the National Board of Church Women United in 1984, and we declared from 1986 to 1991 that we would devote our time to working with poor, marginalized, and the marginalization and the pauperization of women and children. In the time that President Reagan was in office, the wealthy became more wealthy and the poor became poorer, and the most of the poor in this country today are women and children.
Right.
Anyone want to comment on that in comparison to the women's movement? Why? Did the women cause that? Was it the women the cause of the poverty of women? The women are breaking up all the homes? Is the women that are causing this?
I'm hearing so much about community that I'm thinking community is the answer. I'm saturated with community.
Yeah, you're getting a lot of community. What is the cause of our... Now, let me ask a question. Does this give you a little different idea of what the women's movement was all about?
Is all about.
Is all about. Does it a little different than what you came with?
Oh, yes. It's a lot different than what I came with.
I'm taking some of this from a paper that's supposed to be the basis of a thesis that I'm doing, and some of your comments have been extremely valuable. In fact, I've learned a lot. One of the things, and I think we missed the boat here, and I don't know why, whether it was because the press trivialized the conferences. For instance, when we had the Houston conference, the Los Angeles Times hardly mentioned it, maybe 16 times, maybe in a line or two. Generally speaking, it didn't get much what we call PR. There was a little more at the next one, maybe, and a little more
in
Nairobi.
I think that I remember that. right then, now was real popular too.
Well, now, yes, they always, oh, yes. They would take bits and pieces.
Because I was working in civil service, and that was the group that was more familiar to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the Woman's Political Caucus. They've had some press in that way. Some of it very negative, but never... the next statement that I have made in here, which I think is important to understand, to understand the political and social dynamics of the woman's movement, it is necessary to have a vision of what is meant when reference is made to community. How do you envision community? Now, this is what I said. Community is a social group in which people in the group have control over their own destinies, have a sense of belonging, shared values, beliefs, and attitudes, and a shared vision. And I also quoted it from Palmer's book, the one that Bill's using in the morning on community. The Company of Strangers, he calls this public life. Now, we've just been through and still are going through an age of kind of private life. I live in Bellevue. When I moved there, we had big fences. We came home to the family. Sometimes we didn't even know who our neighbors were. And unless we went out of it, we didn't know anybody. And I can remember going there, a woman from my church said, I just had a terrible experience. I just went through the line at the Safeway, and I realized that the woman in front of me belonged to our church, and she was leaving, and I told her, I'm sorry to see you go. And the woman turned to me and said, I'm sorry to have been here. You never spoke to me once. And they lived in the same community and belonged to the same church. Mm-hmm. And this community, this public life we're talking about, can be our world community, national or local. I made friends on that world community. I'm not about to go and bomb a country where I've got friends. Women move in movements. Men have often had leaders. We can think back. Martin Luther, Jesus, John Wesley. What do you name lots of men? Not too many women. I was in the art class today. We're going to discuss that. There's a book there, and where is the art teacher? Is she in here? There she is. And we're discussing the fact. Why don't you say something about that?
Well, it's about women artists from 15 on until now that you've never heard of that were artists whose work was recognized and was in churches and museums. And wonderful names. There was another article, why weren't there any women artists?
Yeah.
Well, there were.
Yeah, that's
a whole thing. They didn't get into history books and they didn't get recorded. So it's...
Women have always been there.
A lot of men have some interesting lives, full lives.
But now I hear this, what do you think about this? I'm not denying that women have always been there.
Well, they always haven't had the opportunity.
But they have not been in on that decision-making progress for thousands of years. We have had a different structure. We call it patriarchy, where men have made, in most countries, most of the decisions. So consequently, apparently artists, female artists, they were recognized, and we have records, but they weren't in our museums for a long time. Does anybody want to comment on that?
You mentioned that the men made most of the decisions. Well, you know, if you, like in a home where you have a husband and wife, well, if you have two guys there, it's pretty hard to make decisions. I mean, sure, she could influence her husband, that's fine. But, I mean, too, it gets confusing and you have a breakdown of the home scene.
If you both make decisions?
You have to have a head. I mean, of every department, whether it's a home or this school or university, the church, it has to be a head.
That's what patriarchy is. Yes, that's what they say. Anybody disagree with that?
Yes. Don't you have a relationship in your home and your husband?
Absolutely.
Where you share a relationship, things and make yes. your decisions together?
Absolutely.
Don't you make your decisions together and share?
Sure, we do.
Yes.
The good homes do. But there still has to be a head.
No, Christ is the head of the home. And
that's
you make
right.
your decisions under.
I agree, Christ is the head.
There's a lot of widows today, and in most of the churches where the men have made the decisions, and when they had, but now the men are gone, so the women can't discuss and make that decision, and in a lot of churches it's still that way, that only the men make the decision, and a lot of these widows feel that they contribute to the church all the time, and they want to be in on the decisions.
Mm-hmm. Oops, we're getting a little bit. This is time. I've got the time here. Well, I hope this has given you a little food for thought, and I will say that tomorrow will come, and I'll bring the feminist argument tomorrow. And I know there are a few feminists around here. I know that. They may not say so, but they are. There are. And present it. Now, no one has to agree with it. This is, but I do think that we have to understand it. And I invite everybody to come, and I wish the men would to talk. And I'm going to leave with this last thing. I had a friend that went to a dinner party, and it was during the time of the decade, and they put out some beautiful little pins, and there was a little quote from China, Chinese, "Women hold up half the sky." You've probably heard that. And my friend said she stood there at this party and was having a good time, and a man looked at it. Well, they can hold up the whole darn world if they wanted, the whole darn sky. Now there are some men who would like to share that responsibility. Women hold up half the sky. Some men would like to have women take that responsibility in a sharing relationship.